Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Blair Underwood, who reads from and discusses his new book, Before I Got Here, The Wondrous Things We Hear When We Listen to the Souls of Our Children, published by Atria. In the weeks to come, we have Chris Elliott, Elliot Perlman, Joseph Ellis, Linda Fairstein, Dave Barry, Julian Barnes, Jill Connor Brown, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you. That was brilliant. Thank you. Good stuff. How's everybody tonight? All right. So good to see some family members here, right here in Denver. Look at you guys. You guys look good. Yes, indeed. Well, thank you. This is like coming home, in a sense. I used to live in Colorado Springs when I was about your age. What grade are you in?
First grade.
You're in first grade? Look how beautiful you are. What grade are you in?
Second.
Well, I lived here when I was in first grade, second grade, and third grade. And my dad was in the military. He was stationed at Fort Carson. So that's why we're here. And I love this state. So thank you for having me back. I should tell you how this book came into being. First of all, doing a book or being a part of a book was the last thing on my mind. It was really actually quite accidental that this whole thing happened. And what happened was, my son, when he was first grade, is how old? I should know that. My daughter's just turned seven. That's right. She's your age. But when my son was four years ago, he was really trying to figure out why jokes were funny. He would see one person say something, and another person would laugh, and he didn't understand the connection. How does that happen? Why is that funny? What I loved about it is I'm thinking, okay, he's going to become an engineer. He wanted to know the mechanics of a joke. I'm thinking, this guy's going to get paid one day. I like that. So I try to explain to him that it's often, it's many things. Sometimes it's the delivery of a joke. Sometimes it's how somebody says something. It's how they look sometimes. But the best jokes, the wittiest jokes, are the ones that have a double meaning, a double entendre. So that became the phrase of the day, double entendre this, double entendre that. Every time he hears something, he says, hey, Daddy, that has two meanings. So later on that evening, I'm driving to the airport, and it's just the two of us in the car, and I look in the rearview mirror, and I see him looking out the window, and he's very, very deep in thought. And I said, Paris is his name. That's a whole other story why we came up with that name, but I'll save that for later. But I said, Paris, what's going on? What are you thinking about? And he said, well, Daddy, I had a dream last night. And hey, last night is a double entendre. He's four at this point now. It means last night, a few nights ago, in his words, and the last night before there are no more mornings and no more nights. I said, that's kind of deep for a four-year-old. But I was kind of half listening, so I turned this all in the introduction to the book so that people understand where it comes from. But I turned down the radio, and I said, wait a minute, say that again. And he repeated himself. He said, the last night before there are no more mornings and no more nights. And that's when all the people go up to heaven. Now, at four, in the Bible, and I should say that I'm a Christian, although this book, it doesn't really adhere to any particular religion or dogma, and I wanted to do that on purpose, because it's really about the spiritual connection that children have. But biblically, they talk about the rapture, when the believers go up to heaven. And I said, wait a minute, is this kid talking about the last days, the end of time? And I said, well, okay, I'm going to go with this. I said, well, who told you that? And he said, well, God told me when he made me, but I only had one ear at the time, so I could only hear a little. I said, okay, that's too much. I literally almost hit the car in front of me and almost crashed. And then we kept on talking, had some more conversations about some other things, and something else which I don't usually put into the story. He said something about when God was making me. I have to think about it because I don't mention it often. He said, when God was making me, and he said, oh, actually, Daddy, you made me, you and Mommy, and God, you gave me my skin color, and God made my skeleton. He said, skeleton. So anyway, this conversation just completely floored me. You mentioned, I think I said it's jaw-dropping in the book, but I was astounded by what he was saying. And you know, skeptics of these type of, I think, insights from children will say, well, you know, that's really no more than just vivid imagination. And I've been asked a lot. I have to say this is the end of a two-week book tour, so I'm even more excited to be here. But over the last 2 weeks with the book tour, they've asked, well, how do you know it's not just imagination? My answer to that is, you don't really know. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. And if it isn't, what does that mean? I mean, let's just go there for a second. Was he talking about witnessing part of his creation? When God made him, he could only hear a little? Was he? You know, Albert Einstein said, we can live our lives two ways. One is though nothing is impossible. The other is though everything is impossible. I choose to believe everything is impossible. I think to have eyesight and to be able to breathe and wake up every day, that's a miracle. The birth of a child is a miracle. Those profound insights, those prophetic insights from children, I believe are miraculous. So I would share this story with a lot of friends because it just stayed with me. I couldn't let it go. It just stayed with me. My first call was to my parents, and I said, wait a minute, did I ever say anything close to this? And my dad promptly said, yeah, you're shaking your head. He said, no, boy, you weren't that bright, trust me. But I'd share this conversation with other friends, and more often than not, people would say, well, wait a minute. Let me share a story with you. Let me tell you what my son or daughter or niece or nephew or grandchild said. And I realized how prevalent these conversations were. And when I say these conversations, it's more than kids say the darndest things. It really is those profound utterances or remembrances, if you will, that kids have, I believe, to another place and time before they got here. And that speaks to an age-old theory. And that theory is that is one of an eternal perspective, that the soul lives on forever. This is all in the introduction, too. I mean, it poses so many questions. If the soul lives on forever, where does it begin and where does it end? Does anybody really know? It's all speculation. But I do believe that children and elderly people have a spiritual conduit, a spiritual connection that we tend to forget. As we grow up and we get into our lives and our careers, we tend to lose that along the way. And children, if we listen to them, give us insight to what that other spiritual connectedness is. I was asked today, well, what does that mean? I mean, okay, so if you listen to your child, what does that mean? And as it was said in the introduction, I'm a father of three. And if I'm not working, I am in those kids' face and in their ears, and I want to hear what they're doing. I want to know who their friends are. I want to know what's going on. And I just believe every nuance, every moment that you spend with that child helps shape that child. And to hear their voice, know their voice is heard, will affect them forever. So even with this story, I mean, what we're talking about here, even their spiritual voice, whatever that spiritual connection is, that voice, if we don't listen to it, you can shut it down. And that's one of the observations I had in this book, and I should mention how we got all the stories. When I was doing a lot of press at that time, I think about a year and a half ago, during Sex and the City, actually, I'd share the story with you, and then I'd say, if anybody has a story similar to that, please log on to beforeigothere.com and share your story. And people logged in from all over the world, and that's how we compiled these stories for the book. But one of the observations, a couple common themes. One common theme had to do with children saying in many different ways that they chose their parents. I was surprised. So I didn't know what to expect, you know, what would come in, but at least five or six stories in the book talk about a child choosing their parents. Another theme that was a recurring theme happened to do with children knowing a sibling in another place. Some would call it heaven. Some would call it someplace else. But knowing a sibling or knowing a grandparent, a great-grandparent, or knowing a family member in another place and time. And the third observation was that all of these conversations really tapered off at around the age of five or six. And I really think it's because these kids in general, become much more self-aware, much more self-conscious, much more self-critical of themselves. From that perspective, from the parental perspective, I think we tend to shut that kind of stuff down because it's, well, many different reasons. But one thing that kept coming up was it's scary. Yeah. It's eerie. I've had parents say, listen, man, well, when I share my story, they said, if my son said that to me, I'd say, shut up, don't say that ever again. I don't want to hear that ever again. It can scare you. And I asked a friend of mine recently who had a similar conversation with her daughter. And I said, well, why would that scare you? Because 9 times out of 10, it doesn't affect the child like that. In fact, it's very comforting to the child. They're not fazed by it. And she said, because if you're dealing with a spiritual dynamic, there can be good spiritual dynamics, good energy, bad energy. And being a parent, you want to be protective. You don't know what kind of energy is coming around that child. So I understand it, but I don't have the answers. I don't profess to be a professional or expert in this field. I leave all of that to the scientists, the spiritual gurus, the metaphysicians, the theologians, all of that. But what we wanted to do with this book was just present it in a way. It's about kids, and it's in their words, and to give credence to what they say, and to, for us to just, as adults, pause for a moment and say, you know what, there might be something there, and we may find comfort in that, and we may also empower our children by giving them that ear. So that's basically where the book came from. And I know I have some time to answer all kinds of questions, but we can talk about the book, we can talk about whatever you want, but I'm here about the book, so we can we'll try to speak mostly about the book. So feel free, any questions about where it came? Oh, also I should mention Danielle Kennedy McCullough, who you mentioned, is my partner in crime in this, and she captured all of the images in the book, I think, the beautiful images. And it's ironic because as a job, what I have to do often is photo shoots, which I despise. What we're going to do today, that's fine, just taking pictures, but just to do photo shoots is one of my least favorite things to do on the planet. And Danielle, who's a friend of ours, my wife and I, was at our son's birthday party, his fourth birthday party, and she captured some of the most incredible candid shots that I'd ever seen. So we were having a conversation about our kids. How you doing? We had a conversation about our kids, and we said, well, wait a minute, you know what? There might just be a book here. You do the images, we'll get the stories, and we'll make it happen. So it's really a dream come true to actually have the book out there, and the fact that it's doing well from all accounts, it's very exciting. So here we are. Come on, any questions? Or we want to start signing? Okay, yes. That is a beautiful baby. I don't know who that baby is. My kids, I would tell you, are on the cover. My oldest son is to my left in the orange shirt. My daughter is to my left, Brielle, and my four-year-old, Blake, is the bottom right-hand corner with his eyes looking off to the side. But this was the day we had the photo shoot, and I just saw that baby on the set, and I said, I got to just grab that little baby. And Danielle caught that picture. Yes? What I've learned mostly are the three observations that I mentioned to you. A lot of lessons learned. I mean, in the whole book world, we were talking about that earlier. Some lessons learned in that. But in terms of what the book and the essence of the book is about, it's made me want to learn more about the history of spirituality, the history of religions. But those are specifics. That's specificity. I mean, I don't want to get bogged down in that. This was designed for a reason, to let it be simple. And even in its look and its aesthetic, with the bright, bold colors and the bright, bold font, in the pictures of the kids, I like the simplicity and the purity and the beauty of their words. But it has, for me, made me want to learn more about the history. I mean, since the beginning of time. Yes. Hey, how you doing?
I'm good.
Another family member. Good to see you.
Yeah.
This is the first, and I have to say, you look at the cover; it says "edited by me," and I wanted that to be just that way because the children are really the authors of this book. I do have another book deal with Simon & Schuster to do a whole nother type of book. Polar opposites. Have any of you in the room heard of Zane? Oh, okay. If you haven't, Zane writes a lot of erotica. There are kids present, so I'll leave that. I won't say too much about that. But I will say that I partnered with two authors who I respect tremendously. One is an author by the name of Tananarive Due, who wrote a book called My Soul to Keep, the Between, a lot of supernatural thrillers. And her husband, Stephen Barnes, who's a science fiction writer. And we collaborated to come up with a story that's more like Zane meets Walter Mosley, and it's a murder mystery series. So we're going to work on that. And the main character that hopefully, if we spin it into a movie later on, I'll play, is someone who works in the Hollywood system. He's a struggling stuntman. So that's kind of my contribution to the team. And they're the great writers, so they'll write that. But there's a third book that I'm writing now that is actually a book I'm very excited about. It's a children's book. And in my spare time, I do the voice of Fatherhood on Nick at Night, which was based on Bill Cosby's book, Fatherhood, back in the day, I think in the early 80s. So the animator of that show and I are collaborating, and we're putting together an animated book right now. So we haven't sold that one yet, so we're going to start pitching that pretty soon. Anybody else? Oh, y'all good. Okay, y'all are easy. That's too easy. Yes. Oh, Medea. Yeah. Yes. Actually, I do want to say that I feel very blessed to say there are two movies coming out in February. There's one that's out in theaters now called G, and I'm shooting a movie now. But the one you're talking about is Madea's Family Reunion. That is a movie. Have any of you in the room heard of Tyler Perry?
Yes.
Yeah, he had a successful series of a series of plays, and his first movie last year was Diary of a Mad Black Woman. Very funny comedy. So Madea's Family Reunion is the sequel to that, which was another one of his plays, but he really took the bulk of that play, Madea's Family Reunion, and then kind of added different elements from different plays. But that movie is hilarious. It's got an incredible cast. Boris Kodjoe was on the cover of Essence this month. Lynn Whitfield, Cicely Tyson, Dr. Maya Angelou, and Tyler Perry playing Madea, the pistol-packing grandma, and himself and the older Joe character. And the other film is a film called Something New, which is a romantic comedy with Sanaa Lathan. Sanaa Lathan, who did Love and Basketball and did a film with Denzel Washington a couple years ago, Out of Time, I think the name of it was. But that's a nice romantic comedy. So very excited about that. And also, I mean, you're all avid readers here. The miniseries I'm doing now is for CBS, and it's based on a Robert Ludlum book who wrote The Bourne Supremacy and The Bourne Identity. It's another political thriller called The Hades Factor, which you may have read. And it's good. It's going to be good. Angelica Houston plays the president. I guess that's a thing now. And Mira Sorvino and Stephen Dorff are in it as well. So please keep an eye out for that. I think that'll be in May sometime. Yeah. All right, so we can start signing then. I mean, unless there's some other questions. Yes, you're going to ask anything. Shoot. Family. I come from a very close-knit family. I mentioned my father was here at Fort Carson. He's a retired Army colonel. And I have an older brother and two younger sisters. And we've just always been a close-knit family. That came from my mother, who was a single, an only child. Because she was an only child, family was everything to her. You know, to have four kids and make sure that we all got along was very important to her, high on the list. And my father, who came from a very big family, for that reason, he felt the same way. So it was instilled in us at a very young age, as I do now with my kids, that nothing is more important than family but God. And I'll ask him, what's important? You know, especially if a friend comes over and they say something wrong to my son, to my daughter, that is his sister, I'll say, what's most important? God, family, then friends. So everything else, I feel so blessed and fortunate to do what I love to do, which is act and create and tell stories. And that manifests its way in different ways. I mean, as an actor, as a producer, as a director. But to do that and still make a living, make a comfortable living, and provide for my family is a blessing. So, I mean, there's no reason to start head tripping and acting crazy. And then, you know, I'm not a spring chicken. I've been in the game about 20 years. You may see some gray hairs on the side. But this is my 20th year in the business. So you kind of see, I mean, really, after 20 years, you see a lot of people come and go. You see a lot of people fall by the wayside. And you can really track, if you study careers and study personalities, you can see most often why they fell by the wayside. And usually it's because they're feeling too good about themselves. So, you know, it's about finding that healthy balance right now. And now is a different chapter in my life because we have kids, you know, just watching them grow every day. It's such a finite time. And I look at my 4-year-old son as opposed to my 8-year-old son, and I feel like it was yesterday when my 8-year-old was that young and younger. So that's why it's been a great run these last 2 weeks doing the book tour, but I'm ready to get home. Yes. I do enjoy those. I do enjoy, and would love to do more, actually. Yeah. That's the best job. I mean, really, out of all, you know, the different projects I've done, very few have my children seen, or can they see. But this one, Fatherhood on Nick at Night, they love. I mean, Daddy goes to work at Nickelodeon, so they love those. They got bragging rights. So they love it. And then also, you know, you come in and you don't have to worry about hair and makeup and wardrobe. You just come in any way you are and just do your voice. So you have lots of voices? I hear voices too sometimes. You said you hear voices or you have voices?
Little girl that resides in my body.
Okay. All right. Yes.
My name is
No, no, that's a good question. No, it's always been there. It's funny. Somebody asked me the other day, or today, this morning, in an interview, we're seeing a different side of you, and it's funny because it's always been there. But it's understandable because she knows from just different characters she's seen. But no, it's always been there. Partially because we grew up in the church. I think we were Methodist at one point, then we were Baptist, and I think we were kept being different things. But we pretty much grew up in the church. But that's religion. That's the study of religion. A spiritual sense is, I think, it's inherent, and it's inherent in all of us. I think we can get further away from it, further away from an understanding of it, and further away from an embracing of it. I think the older I get, I want to embrace it more and learn more about it as I go. But you know, there's an old saying that kind of sums it all up for me, and that is, we are not human beings having a spiritual experience, but we are spiritual beings having a human experience. And I've always believed that. So this is a period of time. I mean, in the acknowledgments to my family in the book, I said, thank you for letting me share this brief shining lifetime with you. Because in the span of things, it's really like that. So no, it's definitely always been there, but this has opened up. And that's why when I had that conversation with my son, you were late coming, I don't know if you heard that, but I had a conversation with my son that inspired the book. And that's why I think it didn't really, it surprised me, but I wasn't afraid of it. And I think the reason I kept asking questions and continuing the conversation is because it was something my mother instilled in us when we started having kids, and that was, talk to them like adults. Or talk to them like people. It has to be age appropriate, but talk to them like people at the age they are. So instead of, you know, that's why I said it's a double entendre, to teach them that. You know, instead of teaching them, for instance, like a pacifier. If it's a pacifier, it's a pacifier, not a binky or whatever else. Then you have to reteach it, and the child has to relearn it. So all that, I think all of that comes into play, you know, just understanding who they are and what they are, and then also learning from them, because that was definitely a teaching moment that my son taught me in that moment. Yeah, thank you. Good question. Yes, ma'am. My birth sign, I'm a Virgo, August 25th. What does that mean? You're like, oh. Is that your thing, astrology? You're into that, or are you really into that? The signs? Do you study that? Oh, okay. Why do you ask?
I'm just nosy.
Oh, you're just nosy. Okay. Okay. Yes. That's a very good question. She plays a huge role in keeping me grounded. I mean, I really don't, because I don't believe in it. I don't start head tripping and start acting out. So she doesn't have to bring me down on that level. But I tell you what does happen, just, and I think it happens to anybody. I don't know. But what does happen is people treat you a certain way, in a good way, positive way. And sometimes if you're not careful, you can surround yourself with yes people, people who tell you only what you want to hear, which is very easy to do. Because you have a lot of people who work for you. You have agents, managers, lawyers, publicists, all of that. She is that one person. She does not care what anybody else says. And she's fine. She's beautiful, but she's very smart. And she's very instinctive. So she'll be the first one, no matter if everybody else is saying one thing, if she doesn't believe it. And she knows me better than anybody. She's not afraid to say it. So in that way, she really keeps me grounded, because I know that's my barometer. You know, everybody else is saying one thing. I can go back to her and say, okay, what's up? What's real? You know what I mean? How we keep it fresh, it's 11 years now. I don't go a day without talking to her or now my kids, now that they're in the picture for the last 8 years. And date nights helped us a lot. You know, since we got married, we try to have a date at least once a week. Doesn't always happen, but it's something we try to do as often as we can. You know, sometimes that date means it may be about just getting a hotel in town. Doesn't mean going away for the weekend, because sometimes that's not realistic, but just having time for yourselves. You have to. And again, it's funny, I think how often I think back to my mom said this, my dad said this. I feel so fortunate because I had parents that really guided us. And I think that's one reason it's imperative to me. Partially because it's what I know, it's where I come from, but I'm constantly in my kids' lives because my mom especially, and my dad, but he was working more often than not, but they were constantly guiding us. And I see that with my kids now. So it's just making the effort. And I got married when I was 30. I was enjoying my single life up until then. And people had said before that, again, just trying to listen to wisdom that had gone before me.
They said, don't get married before you're 30, because your priority is going to change, your taste is going to change, all of that. And I think about, whoo, if I had married the young lady I was dating when I was 25 and 26 and 27, I would be miserable right now. So part of it was waiting for the right one, and I feel I'm very clear that I got the right one, so I'm not letting it go.
Question. What did you want to say? You had a question on your mind. I see your mind racing. You! Stop lying. You.
Okay, so should we start the signing? No, we get a chance to meet. You do have, now you have a question. Okay. She always, I don't dance that often, but she always likes to see me dance. And I said, okay, well, I may just on our wedding day just do something real funky for you. So we did. So all the groomsmen and myself put this whole routine together. It was like a hip-hop kind of funky groove thing. And she had no idea. So when the beat came in, we started doing our thing, she was very surprised. And I was glad, because it's not going to happen again. I told her this is the last time. Yes. No, I couldn't model. You know, I think like my first month in New York, when I couldn't pay the bills and I was trying to get a job doing anything, I went to Ford Modeling Agency. And the agent looked at me and she said, I don't know if you can tell, but I have a lot of scars on my face. I have a scar there, a scar there, a scar there. I was always falling out of trees and rock. That's from my brother, a rock fight we had. And they said that you're going to have, you can take pictures, that's fine, but we're going to have to airbrush everything. And she said it's going to be a lot of work, it's going to be expensive. And I remember walking out of there because I just come out of going to college for 3 years studying theater. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to do this. I'm gonna do what I was trained to do, and hopefully if everything works out, they'll take pictures anyway. Which is ironic, because now I say it's one of my least favorite things to do, is take pictures. But yeah, I started off doing local dinner theaters in Virginia. And I would go to school my junior year in high school, and in the evening, my sister Marlo and I were in a play called Finian's Rainbow in Colonial Heights. So it was just great for me because I got a chance to be on stage and perform every night, go to school in the daytime and perform at night. And that got me started. And then the next season I did another play. And then I went to college at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh and studied music theater, actually. So we had all the theater training with the people who were only studying acting. But in addition, we had to dance, we had to sing, we had to do piano, solfege. If you remember the movie Fame, I can hold a tune. No, but you remember the movie Fame. It was very much like that on a college level. Yeah, so in fact, I just did, you may be familiar with the play Pearly, which won Grammys in the 1970s, Cleavon Little and all that, and Melville Moore. But I just done that in New York in April. And that was my first time singing and dancing since college, which was great. I mean, to do it on the New York stage for the New York audiences was great. So I studied theater, and then I moved to New York. And, you know, my third year of college, it just got too expensive. And we were right in that bracket where my father was, an Army colonel, so he made a certain amount of money. But my older brother was in college. I was in college. It was too expensive to get financial aid, but it was just too tight. So I said, I'm just going to take a little 8x10 picture and start knocking on doors and see what happens. And I did. And as fate would have it, it worked out, because my second day in New York, I got on The Cosby Show as a walk-on. But just to be on that set, in their first year, when they were a phenomenon right out of the box, 1985 we're talking about, it helped to have something to talk about when I go into meetings with agents to say, you know, they wanted to see, well, who's this kid who just came to town and got on The Cosby Show that fast? And I didn't do anything. I just walked in the door with one line. But it helped. And sometimes you have to have anything that's going to get you in the door or give you a leg up, and that gave me a leg up and just kind of started the ball rolling. All right.
We were missing Bobby Blue, right?
Bobby Blue, you remember that?
One Life to Live.
That's right. Taking it back.
That was Bobby Blue.
Yeah, that's right. That was 85 too. 85 was a big year because I had started off, you know, it was at The Cosby Show and then One Life to Live, and then I did my first movie, a movie called Crush Groove, where I played Russell Simmons, who's become this iconic figure now of hip hop culture, and I played Russell. And then I moved to Los Angeles after that and started doing some other TV series. Yes. My favorite character. I think my favorite character is the character that's furthest from me. I did a movie in 94 called Just Cause with Sean Connery and Lawrence Fishburne.
Yeah.
And the irony is because it's so not who I am, this character ended up being a serial killer and some other terrible things he did to kids, ironically.
But because he is so different from me, I became an actor to be different people. And I think, the first half of my career during L.A. Law and at the City of Angels, where I played a surgeon, a doctor, and High Instinct, where I played a cop, they were uplifting, professional, positive characters, which is great. But after setting that foundation, now what's great is, like in Madea's Family Reunion, the character I play is not the good guy. The character I played in G is not the good guy. And there have been characters along the way, like in Posse, who was the sheriff who was not the good guy. I prefer those characters because it's furthest away from my belief system. I didn't get in the game to be a rapper and, be myself. I'd rather play characters that are not me.
Well, yeah. I loved
you,
Mama Flores.
Oh, Mama Flores.
Yeah.
Actually, one of my favorites, too. Mama Flores was different because it was closest. It was closer to me. It was for polar opposite reasons. But that one especially, my mother at the time was suffering from MS. She still has MS. And my sister was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And that was a miniseries based on an Alex Haley book. And, it was all about this family, that whole the family unit, which means so much to me. So she was really in this dark place at that time. So to do this piece that resonated with our relationship was phenomenal. So and also the character I played, I got to age from 15 to 50.
You still look good.
And God bless you. but you have to understand, when I saw an actress by the name of Cicely Tyson do a miniseries, the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. Do you remember how she aged?
Yeah.
So here this was so many years later where I got a chance to play opposite her, number one, but also play a character where I could age along with her, and she played my mama. So yeah, so that's very special. That's close to my heart, that whole project. Yeah. All right. Yes, one more. Oh, Sidney Poitier. Easily. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Because see, the thing is, when you're in the business and you work with other actors, you see that we're just actors. We just have jobs, and it just happens that millions of people see what you do, but it's just a job. And then people come along who have that gift, who have that presence, that is above and beyond just having a job. And Sidney Poitier is one of those few people that has that. He walks in a room, and it's like royalty walking in the room. Very few people have that, either from his generation or this generation. Very few people had it. I tell you who had it too. Michael Jackson had it. And it's terrible to see what he's done to himself and what's happened to his career, but that was a gift. You look at those early videos when he first started, it's phenomenal, phenomenal. But that's rare. And so, yeah, Sidney Poitier, he's one of those people, when he walks from, everybody's in awe. Well, thank you. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Chris Elliott, Elliot Perlman, Joseph Ellis, Linda Fairstein, Dave Barry, Julian Barnes, Jill Connor Brown, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on November 17th, 2005.